Amen. All right, Genesis 37, of course, this is where the focus shifts over to Joseph, but it's about Joseph, but it's not about Joseph. Let's read Genesis 37, verses 1 and 2. Who will grab that for us? Hank.
Sons of Zephon, and his father's wives, and Joseph's brothers. They bad reports to them to his father.
Okay. So how does the chapter start out, focusing on who? Yeah, Jacob. And it says in the New King James, the history of Jacob. There, who has another translation that says something else there? It says genealogy? Does anybody have something different? Generations. Okay. This really, I know it doesn't seem like it, but it's really focused on Jacob and his legacy, but it's being expressed or recorded through his sons. So it begins an account of his descendants and the events that unfold that lead them down into the land of Egypt, which then sets us up for the book of Exodus and everything that follows with the development of God's plan through the descendants of Abraham. The major focus is, of course, on Joseph primarily, but who's the other focus here? Who else is prominent, really, from chapter 37 going forward? There's a secondary, if you will. Let me give you a hint. Chapter 38 focuses solely on him, Judah. Okay. It gives us this picture of Joseph and of Judah and their roles in the things that unfold during this time, which are significant, of course. In 37, you have Judah as a heartless brother who seized an opportunity to get rid of a brother's and make money by selling him off into slavery. Chapter 38, you have him as a failed father and immoral man who ends up publicly confessing his sin. You fast forward to when the brothers are trying to get Jacob to let them go back to Egypt to take Benjamin with them. Judah's the one that steps up to get that to happen. And then Judah is the one who offers himself as a slave in place of Benjamin. And so Judah, as you look at that, you see his character, the change and the development. But then, of course, when Jacob gives the birth, the blessings to his sons, Judah is the one, he specifically says, you know, the one through whom Shiloh is going to come. So Judah is very prominent throughout this. Joseph, of course, we have the account of him and everything that he did, the hero, if you will, of the story. And it said, how old was he when all this starts out? 17 years old. How old is he when the book ends up? At his death. 110 years old, okay? So we've got this time period in his life, just short of 100 years of covering the things that unfold in his world, his life, but it covers his brothers as well. So if Joseph is 17, how old is Reuben approximately? Anybody remember? Reuben's about 24 years old. Roughly at this time. Remember that when Jacob arrived in Haran, he said, I'll work for Rachel for 7 years. He worked for 7 years, Then he got Leah. A week later, he got Rachel. And then there was the 7-year time period that he said, I'll work another 7 years for Rachel. Again. But it's in that 7-year time period that Leah begins to have children, all the rivalry back and forth of them trying to compete with each other. And then at the end of that 7-year period is when Joseph was born. And that's when he went to Laban and said, hey, it's time for me to go. I need to head back. And then he worked out a deal where he ended up staying another 6 years before he ran off. But here's the thing. It's that 7-year, that second 7-year period where those boys are born. And so there's a bounding limit on their ages. So when we read about this, it helps us to understand how these brothers, at least to me, at these ages, could behave the way they did, just like Levi and Simeon before. They're not very smart. They're acting on passion when they go and they attack Shechem and killed all the men in there. But it just gives us an understanding of their approximate ages. It's not like Reuben and Simeon and Levi are 50, 40-year-old men even at this time, and they're doing this to their brother. So, thinking about that, of course, Benjamin's an exception. He was, it's estimated about 15-year time period actually between him and Joseph in ages. So Benjamin's a little chap at this time. But let's now read verses 3 through 11. Let's get the first part of this here. Who will read that for us? Genesis. Go ahead, Philip. All right, so question number one that I'd asked is, what stirred the resentment and hatred of Joseph's brothers? So we'll kind of break these down. So what's that first thing that's mentioned? And it's actually back in verse 2. No. He did? How about verse 2? Right. So Joseph sees something that his brothers are doing that's not right. It's not appropriate. Whatever it is, he takes that report to his father, and they, of course, realize this, so they're upset about that. Well, Joseph is going and telling on us, if you will. Now, again, this isn't, you know, 5 and 6 and 7-year-old boys. These are, you know, late teens, early 20s, and this report's going to their father. And one of the things it shows us is that these young men are being affected and influenced by the culture around them. In fact, chapter 38 brings it out very clearly that this is a serious problem here. But here, they're not acting right. And Joseph, having a conscience against that, goes and tells his father, hey, This is what they're up to. They were sinful men, and they resent the fact that they've been found out, if you will, through their little brother. So what else is there that was mentioned just a moment ago? Before the dreams. Okay, Israel loved Jacob more than the others. Why does it state he loved him more than the others? And then what else is in the background of this?
He was the son of a favorite wife. He was protected when they came to meet Esau. It's a kind of a lifelong thing where he's been showed favorite.
Right. Jacob has been very overt in who it is that he favored in the family. From Rachel and her firstborn, Joseph. Later, we know that he favored Benjamin. He, at all costs, he wanted to try to protect Benjamin. But yes, this is that favoritism that's just playing out through here. And it said it was his son of his old age. I think if memory serves me, he was 91 when Joseph was born. Do people who are older, who have children late in life, do they tend to treat them different than maybe children they had earlier in life? Yeah. And so there may be just a natural part of that that's unfolding as well. And somebody mentioned a while ago, so how does he unquestionably show the favoritism here? Yeah, that tunic. So what about that tunic? Any thoughts on it?
Maybe a coat of many colors, which would have been rare. In other places, the same word is used as a royal robe, but it was probably something that wasn't very conducive to working hard.
Okay. So he's the one going to check on them while they're in the field. He's not out in the field later in the story. Clint. Right.
This is my favorite son who I love.
Right.
Piggyback on that. Hey, in case any of you boys missed it, this guy is the one that I like better than the rest of you.
Right. Right. So what does that do for Joseph? It's a target. It's exactly right. It just makes him a target because you look at this. It says in verse 4, the brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers. What was their reaction? They hated Joseph. Can't even talk to him nicely. Where's their resentment not focused? On Jacob, the one who's actually the problem here. But isn't that funny how that works, that our ill feelings don't go toward the one who's discriminating. Our ill feelings go toward the one who's receiving the favoritism. It's not like they're unique in history in this. The person who has the advantage is the one that we generally get upset with, not what's behind that brought the advantage to them. And so here they are, they hate Jake or Joseph. They cannot speak peaceably to him. And the way I see that practically day by day, they're around where they live, they're eating meals and things and passing each other through the day, and they cannot tell him, hello, how you doing? Good day, have a good night. Anything like that, it's just negativity pouring out of them, or coldness and resentment showing in their faces as they pass him day by day. Any other thoughts down through 4? So One of the problems is that their father favors him above all, this coat of many colors. The other one being the bad report, Joseph is not in step with them in their behavior and how they're living. And then verses 5 and following, what is it that comes up that's a serious issue? Those dreams.
Yeah, Paul. He has those dreams, and I don't, from my understanding, he doesn't even understand them himself, and he's trying to share it to get some insight.
Okay. So he has this dream, and that first dream is about what? Okay, it's about sheaves. That's the imagery in it. What's the obvious meaning? And everybody gets it. It's not like, well, that's very interesting. I wonder what's going on there. Yeah. He knew it. They knew it. You're all going to be bound down to Joseph. Second dream. Sun, moon, stars. Okay? Similar, slightly different, but when you bring the sun and the moon into it, it's parents, right? And when it says shall your mother and I, probably that's a reference to Leah being the wife. You know, she was the proper wife of Jacob, and probably a reference to her because Rachel's been dead for some time now. But just that idea that everybody would bow down to him, the meaning is obvious. Again, there's no ambiguity. Now, as Paul said, how that's going to unfold, nobody understood. Nobody realized it at the time. This was God revealing, here's what's going to happen down the road. And we'll, Lord willing, talk more about that when we get to Joseph being down in Egypt. But he's conveying, here's what's going to happen in the future. Nobody could believe it. The brothers didn't believe it. His own father didn't believe it. But what does it say about his father?
He kept the matter in his mind and retained the thinking about his two dreams.
Okay, so what's the idea of that, him keeping it in mind? Right, right, exactly. Had Jacob had dreams before?
Yes.
Right? With the angels ascending and descending. So it's, now that was a long time before, but he's not unfamiliar with this kind of communication from God. And so he keeps that matter in mind, not really understanding fully what it's all about, but he, even though he scoffed at the idea and rebuked his son, what do you mean? That's just not the natural order of things. It's always the younger people bowing down to the older people. That's the way it's supposed to be, but now it's going to reverse itself. Mike? Yeah, it's puzzling. Clint, do you have something? Yes. Yes, there are some who have speculated, well, you know, him giving that report, it's like being the brat brother. Hey, I got you now, guys. Some who've speculated, well, he's puffed up, he's arrogant about the dreams, and he's like shoving it in their face. I personally don't see any of that in here. You go through the rest of his life, and you see the kind of character that he has. to me, the Holy Spirit is laying out here, here's the kind of person he was, here's what he went through, and here's where he ends up. Whereas Laban, you know, very at the very beginning of Laban, when Abraham's servant first showed up and he had all this stuff, you start to get an inkling of where Laban's focus is and what it is that he wants. And it's spelled out very clearly later. And here, kind of opposite of that, Joseph has a good character through the account that we're given of him. But it says that his brothers envied him. What does the Bible tell us about envy? And what's this issue here?
Well, the Bible gives us many examples how envy is the beginning of a process that leads to a very unfavorable result. Envy leads to malice or hatred and malice, and then eventually it leads to murder.
Okay. Right. So how should the brothers have reacted when their father showed favoritism to Joseph and made that special coat? How should they have reacted? Should have rejoiced with him. They should have, hey, he's being looked after, he's being cared for, he's favored. In other words, instead of being bitter, envious toward that. And here's the thing. In our lives, there are people around us who we see as favored. And instead of being angry, instead of being upset, why isn't that me? Why are they getting it? This isn't fair. We should be thinking, well, good for them. I'm happy for that. And move on. Otherwise, you could get entangled in the kind of things that we're getting ready to read about. And we think, no, that could never happen. Yeah, it happens every single day. People allow these emotions to get away and control them, and they end up doing things they never thought they would do. All right, any other thoughts down through 11? Okay, so verses 12 and following down through here, down to 17. We're not going to read all of that, but what is it that unfolds and where are they? Let's just grab verse 12 to begin with. Verse 12, we will read this one. Genesis 37, 12. Clint?
Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem.
Okay. Why is it mentioning this? Okay, Shechem, and there's another thing in there. What do we know when he first ended up near Shechem? What did Jacob do? What did Jacob do? He bought a piece of land. If you remember that, he bought a piece of land. So that may be why they're going up here. This is our land. We can go up and we can freely graze. It's good grazing area. They've moved away because of what Levi and Simeon and the other brothers did. But now they've gone up there, which is interesting that they would go up there to do it. What would drive them? Why would they even head up there? Jacob obviously knows where they've gone. Well, maybe because they've gone to that land that they actually have purchased and own up there. And so they're up there with the flocks. Joseph is not with them. Obviously, Benjamin is not with them. And Jacob decides, well, Joseph, you need to go up there. You need to find out how your brothers are doing. And so he heads up there. When he heads up there, what happens when he gets up to the area of Shechem? Well, they're not there. And so what's Joseph doing? Verse 15. He's trying to figure out where do they go. He's looking around. You know, maybe going up on a rise and seeing if he can see them. Well, maybe they're just not in this specific area, but he's looking for them. Now, Shechem, the area is about 50 miles north of Hebron where they are living. And so they've gone about 50 north, and then the man tells them they've gone where? To Dothan. That's about another 14 or so miles further north. And it's along a trading route, which is why we read about what happens here a little bit later. But they've gone up there. Their father's concerned. You can understand why their father would be concerned because of the history of the area. You know, are they okay? I kind of want to know what's happening up there. Sends Joseph on the air, and Joseph doesn't find him. Goes on further up north, and then that's where we come into the latter part of this. So let's read verses 18 to 22, please. 37, 18 to 22. Mike. Okay, so as he's approaching them, they see him. How could they so easily spot him? Because he's got the target, right? He's wearing, we know for a fact he's wearing it out there. So they can easily see him. I mean, beyond the fact that we generally can recognize our family, even at a distance, just the way they walk, the way they carry themselves, we very often can tell, oh, that's, I know who that is. Even if they have their back to us, we kind of get, okay, that's who that is. But here, he obviously has his coat on. They see him out there. And I asked you to explain, and we've touched on this, but question number two, explain the progress of the brothers' feelings and where it led them. Where does Jesus speak about these issues, and what does he say? So what about these brothers? Let's just circle back to this for a second. They see him, and what are they talking about?
A little bit of hatred grows. A little bit of hatred grows into an enormous amount.
Okay. What are they talking about when they see him?
Murder.
Murder. Is it beyond them to murder someone? Levi and Simeon, there's no joking around. This is not them sitting there with idle, boastful talk. This is them, we're going to kill him. We are tired of this. We can get away with it. So they're talking about fratricide here, murdering their very own brother. Where does Jesus talk about these kinds of things? Ron. If you would read that for us. Mark 7, 20 to 23. Go ahead.
And he said, what comes out of a man, that defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of man, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. And these evil things come from within and defile a man.
Okay. So what's the lesson there? What's the warning?
Well, I think you indicated at the very beginning of our study that they were starting to become influenced by the other nations, and it was recognized by Joseph. And they are not protecting their minds. They're not protecting themselves. They're not going where they say they go. We can see a continued breach in their integrity. And as you mentioned later on, it only waxes worse and worse.
Right, right. We have to subdue our feelings, our hearts, our minds, where we allow our mind to go, because it can go from that bitterness to murder. It can go from coveting to theft. It can go from lust to adultery. So if we're not getting a handle on it, when it first starts to pop up in our hearts, we let that go, it leads to those actions. And those actions, not saying that the thoughts themselves don't do damage, they certainly do damage to us and potentially to other people, but our actions most certainly affect people who are around us and bring great harm and sorrow and pain to them. And so this is a great illustration of the fact that something that you would think would start out small, something that people feel justified in. Do you think these boys felt justified in hating their brother? They felt completely justified in it. They thought, this is not right, this is unfair to us, and here's how we're going to fix it. This is what we're going to do to make things right. We're going to kill him and get rid of him. Any other thoughts on that? Exactly. The Sermon on the Mount there, especially chapter 5, is just drilling away at what's in your heart, what's in your mind. You've got to get a hold of that. So very good. All right, so they see him, verse 19. You know, the dreamer is coming, and that's an epithet against him. And, you know, we'll cast him into some pit. Let's kill him and cast him into a pit. And that was the idea. They have water pits, or at least at this time they had water pits over there that would be in their fields and things that the rain would collect in. They would cover these dugout places or these natural holes. They would put plaster in there to give it some retention of the water when it would flow in. And they would cover them up with rocks. And so they figured, well, we can kill him and throw him in one of those and cover that back up and nobody will ever know what happened to him. Nobody will ever find his body, and we'll just say some beast has killed him, which they actually use that story in the end. But what will become of his dreams? Well, what do their actions lead to? The fulfillment of the dreams. Here they are thinking, we're going to put an end to this. And it was key to these dreams being fulfilled. And not to get too deep into it, but you fast forward to Jesus Christ and his enemies saying, we're going to get rid of him. But what did it do? That was key to exactly what God wanted in the redemption of man, the sacrifice of Christ. Mike? Yep, very good. Very good. All right, let's read 23 to 30. 23 to 30, who'll read that? Mike?
So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robes, the robes of many colors that he wore. And they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty, and there was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Joseph said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother and our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph to Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he tore his garments. He returned to his brothers and said, the boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?
Okay. So you see Reuben is not on board with the plan. He wasn't on board with it to start with. And I had asked that in question number three. How did Reuben initially react to his brother's plans? And what lesson can we learn from that? So back up there in verse 21 and 22, how did he respond to them when he hears them talking about murder? Yeah, let's not kill him, but let's just cast him into a pit. But what he didn't reveal to them was what? Yeah, I'm going to take him back to his father. Why would Reuben want to do that, by the way? Okay. He had committed adultery with his father's concubine, and he's on the outs. It may be trying to gain some favor back. Hey, if I take his favorite son back to him, maybe smooth things out a little bit. But then also, being the oldest, he's responsible. He's the guy that has to give an account when he gets back for everything. So it's going to fall on him. So he has this alternate plan. And then when he comes back and finds him not there, of course, he's distraught. But is there any lesson in this? So you've got how many brothers who are out there conspiring this? How many brothers total are there? Okay, so there's Benjamin still at home. We deduct him. There's 11. Joseph shows up. So there's 10 of these guys talking about it. There's one who says, no, let's not do that. Okay. Be the one to say no against something that's wrong. Be the one to say, no, this isn't going to happen. We're not going to allow this. So Reuben was able at least to get it to where just throw him in a pit. Now, he planned to come back and rescue him instead of when he first got there, falling on him and killing him right away, because that's what they wanted to do. Their passions were flowing. They were hot and ready to get after it. But Reuben slowed that down, cast him into a pit. Mike. Okay. When he first shows up, verse 23, what do? Took that. What are they trying to do here? Humble him. They're trying to strip away that favored status. I mean, literally, they are ripping that off of him. You are not going to be favored anymore. You're not going to have this any longer. Just to me, interesting how that unfolded. And they take him, they cast him into a pit. Says it was empty. That one didn't have any water in it. And then verse 25, what do? Cold-hearted, callous, because later, what we read about, Joseph is pleading with them and crying, don't do this. Man, these guys, it shows the depth of their hatred, their callousness toward him. They look up, they see the Ishmaelite traitors, and who's got the plan, and what is that plan? Hey, Judah, let's not kill him. He's our flesh. He's our brother. Let's sell him. And evidently, they plan to split the proceeds up among themselves.
Back to Reuben, he did say let's not kill him. But Reuben's a failed leader. He's the firstborn. He's the oldest. He's responsible. He's a failed leader. And he did say let's not kill him. But he didn't say, look, guys, this is wrong. We're not doing this. I'm taking him home. He's a failed leader. And here's where you see the shift with Judah becoming the leader. Now, his leadership is not real good here, but you see the change gradually take place all the way to the end of the book, Genesis 49, where Jacob is giving blessings to his sons. Like, Reuben, you're out. You're a failure as the firstborn as a leader. And you see that here, where he knows the right thing, but he doesn't follow through with it.
Yes, yes. He, in trying to stop this, he does it surreptitiously, if you will. But exactly right. Judah, this is showing us, Judah's the real leader. They follow his plan. And then later, he's the one leading things when all the brothers are going back and forth. So exactly right. It brings it out for us, Nancy. Right. Yeah. Yeah, we won't touch him. Yeah. So it's all good. And we make a little money in the process. So they agree to that. They sell him to, now it talks about in one place Ishmaelites, another place Midianites. The best explanation I've seen is it's a mixture. They would cooperate together in various things. But be that as it may, they sell him off. Now, let me ask you this. Would you rather be dead or sold into slavery? Okay, I know the end of the story, so I'm voting for slavery. Okay, because things don't end up too bad. And that's the thing. You know, there's a part of me, you know, I'll die for my freedom. Well, is that exactly the right thing that I should be thinking about? Because the hand of God and His providence is here. You know, there are times we understand, look, stand up, put your life on the line. That's the right thing to do. But this wasn't a question of something morally right or wrong on Joseph's part. Just would you rather be sold into slavery, Joseph, or would you rather your brothers kill you? Well, I'll go the slavery route for what unfolds here, what we see. So he's sold. Understanding in this whole account, you know, people that are supposedly close to you, they can turn on you. Don't be surprised about that in life. Somebody, maybe even your own family, becomes envious of you, and they may act out against you. Innocent people suffer. He didn't do anything to deserve this. And so innocent people do suffer, and there are times when we're completely helpless about our circumstances in life. We can't do anything about it. John.
And this was not some good thing that they did, selling him into slavery. There's a psalm that says that he was put into chains. He had a metal collar put around his neck with a chain on. His hands were bound. But I think in Amos specifically, the nations around Israel were condemned.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly right. They are wrong all the way around. All right, so verses 31 to 35. Let's read that. Who'll get that? Okay, Stephen. So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" And he recognized it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son for many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and a captain of the guard. All right, so they take his coat and they have this plan, cover it in blood to try to cover up what they have done to their brother. And when they present it to their father, how do they present that? Gary? Okay, so what's another way to word that? That's exactly right. deception, manipulation here. Okay? There was evidence, but it was false evidence that they presented to him. So question number five I had asked, discuss the feelings of Jacob. Were they justified, and is there a lesson for us? Okay, jump forward 22 years when he finds out his son's alive. How does he feel then? Okay, in other words, when the evidence changed, he accepted that truth. One of my favorite things to point out here is there are some people who are taught error. They're given false evidence about God's plan of salvation. And they believe it. We understand, okay, they believe it because that's the way they were raised. That's what they were taught. That's what somebody said to them. And so they've believed it, and they've acted based on that belief. But then when they are presented with truth, they don't want to let go of that error. That would be like Jacob 22 years later clinging to this bloody coat and saying, hey, this says he's dead, when he could go and stand right in front of Joseph. There's some people, you can show them the Word of God. This is what it says. And they'll be like, no, I don't want to listen to that. I want to hang on to this over here that I learned a long time ago. And we could see how irrational that would be for Jacob. Well, it's just as or more irrational for people to hold on to error instead of accepting and believing the truth. Nancy.
Well, I think another strong point in this is that you can jump to a conclusion very quickly. And that happens often, or it happens, I guess, over the totality of time, you can say frequently, even in the church. When you see something, you don't understand what's going on or what really happened, and you jump to a conclusion, make a decision based on not all the facts at all.
Right. That is a good cautionary tale there with you need to make sure you gather all the facts as the very best that you can. Okay, so they sold this lie to their father, kept it up for 22 years. That's the thing that amazes me, that none of them cracked for 22 years in this, and seeing their father in his mourning that entire time, really. But just with the minute we have left, in chapter 38, we're not going to spend any more time in it than this, but it is an integral part of the history of Jacob. As 37 opened up, you see that change in Judah's character here. It highlights the need for Jacob's family to get out of Canaan, because Judah marries a Canaanite. His sons are so wicked that God kills them. And that's pretty rare in Scripture. I mean, sons of Eli, God had it in for them and killed them, and we read about the things they were doing. But here he kills both of his sons, or two of his sons. And so you see how this culture has affected them, and Judah's aligned himself with the people of the land. And it just illustrates they need to get out of there. This is a very real problem, and they need to be isolated. And that's what ends up happening down in Egypt. And there's a contrast here between Judah's character and Joseph's, because chapter 39, you see Joseph acting on the exact opposite end of the spectrum of what Judah does here in relation to Tamar under the circumstances. So completely different. Now then, it also, of course, gives us a tie-in with the lineage of Christ, because Christ came through Perez there. But we'll pick up, Lord willing, chapter 39 next week.